You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
1 year ago, after Russian separatists took over parts of eastern Ukraine, the country elected the pro-Western candidate Petro Poroshenko to be their next president. Since then, the Malaysia Airlines flight MH17 was shot down over rebel-held territory. Fighting in the region has escalated, and the ceasefire in February has all but fallen apart. Even if you read the news stories coming out of the area regularly, you're likely to find the situation there quite confusing. So to help us unravel this complicated conflict, we've invited to our show Andrew Kramer, a New York Times correspondent based in Moscow, and Sabra Ayers, a writer for Al Jazeera America, who is based in Kiev. Welcome to our show.
Thank you.
Andrew.
Thank you.
In February of last year, before Poroshenko was elected, the pro-Kremlin president, Viktor Yanukovych, was ousted from power. Was that because of the Maidan demonstrations? Had they been really effective?
Yes, it was a direct result of the Maidan demonstrations. The culmination of those demonstrations came on February 18th through February 22nd, despite European efforts to broker a deal that would have left Yanukovych in power until the end of 2014, at least when there would be a new election, he fled the capital, and the leaders of the demonstration then assumed power in Kiev.
And who filled the seat of the president after Yanukovych was gone?
Well, it was a chaotic time at first. Power initially fell to the parliament under the Ukrainian constitution. The opposition lawmakers, together with former pro-government lawmakers, elected a new speaker, Oleksandr Turchynov, and then this speaker assumed the power of acting president until a new election was held several months later.
One of the people who was being proposed as a possible new president was Yulia Tymoshenko, who had been president but also had been in jail. It turned out she didn't do very well. Had she lost her appeal for the Ukrainian public?
I think so. She was imprisoned. She was sidelined by the former president Yanukovych. Of course, he said it was the court system that had put her in prison. There was a lot of suspicion that because of her political activity, this was retribution on his part. Nonetheless, her absence made her less relevant during the Maidan demonstrations. She was not a leader of these street actions. And when she was released in the final days and after Mr. Yanukovych had fled, her reception on the square was lukewarm at best. And it turned out that Ukrainian politics had really moved on from Tymoshenko. She was seen as one of the old guard figures. She's still active as a political party in Ukraine, but is not such a relevant politician today.
Sabra, once Yanukovych was gone, how did the political situation in eastern Ukraine change?
Well, as soon as Yanukovych was gone, then we started seeing sort of a backlash on the upheaval that Maidan had sparked. And so we immediately saw what at first they said weren't Russian troops coming into Crimea, but they were, in fact, Putin did admit in the end that they were. And they immediately started sort of working that angle in Crimea, which, of course, stirred up problems in the east with some pro-Russia sentiment out there in the industrialized east, and we saw the takeover of buildings very soon after the annexation of Crimea.
Did the majority of the residents of Crimea consider themselves to be Russian?
Well, it sort of depends on, I mean, yes, in many ways they did. That doesn't mean that that the referendum that was held in Crimea, we could say, it's difficult to say that that was sort of a legal way to do it, or that the results of that were what exactly the people were thinking. The majority in Crimea do feel, they will say, feel more Russian, feel closer to the Russian state than they do to Ukraine. Historically, they've felt that way. In Crimea was largely made up of retired Soviet military people that had been put down in or been sent down to Crimea to retire. So they did feel that connection. The language there is generally Russian. But polls showed that most people did sort of side that way. However, they weren't as the polls that had been taken before the crisis started did not accurately reflect the outcome of the referendum. So had that referendum for you know, Crimea status been held in such as the way that they held the referendum in Scotland, for example, we might have seen a larger spread.
Now, Russian media often suggests that part of the tension in the area is that there are just so many fascists working in Ukraine. How strong are the remnants of the old fascists and, I guess, the neo-Nazis in Ukraine?
Well, look, I mean, this is something that's been played up in the media a lot, and I think to say, I think that it gets overplayed a lot. Are there people in Ukraine that are, you know, sympathize with the neo-Nazi ideology? Sure, of course there are. Is it as large as the Russian media paints out? Absolutely not. I think that you know, this is the way that the Kremlin can play up to people's you know, emotions in this situation, given the history here in this country of what happened in World War II and that sort of thing. And so, you know, this is a tool that's been used to manipulate the population into polarizing it into picking sides.
Andrew, in the Western media, this has largely been depicted as a white hat, black hat thing. Vladimir Putin wearing the black hat. But isn't it a bit more complicated?
Well, everything is more complicated than it appears on the surface, and I suppose this is no exception. The way that Russians perceive this conflict is obviously quite a bit different than the way many people in the West do. There was a real surge of national pride after the annexation of Crimea, a feeling that the Russian nation had been shortchanged in the settlement after the collapse of communism, that they had been geopolitically disadvantaged, that the economy had suffered, and that now it was payback time, really, time to reject some of the tenets of that settlement.
But Khrushchev is the person who gave Crimea to Ukraine.
Well, that's right. But at the time, Ukraine was part of the Soviet Union, so it was an administrative boundary. Everything was run by Moscow. At the time of the breakup, there was discussion that Crimea, which was an autonomous region, might become part of Russia. But since it had been in Ukraine, the same general pattern that applied to the entire former Soviet space, that these administrative borders would remain as they were and become the new national borders, was applied to Ukraine. And there are many places where conflict broke out, and many more perhaps where conflict could have broken out if these borders were to be disputed. Everybody decided at the time that they would accept these borders, including Russia.
I'm talking with Andrew Kramer of the New York Times and Sabra Ayers of Al Jazeera America. Sabra, what was Petro Poroshenko's background before he was elected president?
Well, Petro Poroshenko has been in politics for several years. He had even served in the previous, the ousted president, Yanukovych's administration. But he is also known as one of Ukraine's oligarchs. He is the chocolate king, as they call him. He owns a large chocolate factory called the Roshan Factory, and as well as one of the biggest media holdings with the Channel 5, which is a popular station here. So he is sort of, like many Ukrainian politicians, has a mix in business and a mix in politics, which has called many to question if he is one of the oligarchs that has been blamed for some of Ukraine's most of Ukraine's corruption, and that's been sort of an ongoing political struggle for him. On the other hand, some people argue that the industry he's in, which is candies and confectioneries, isn't quite as tainted as the natural resources industries, where a lot of the corruption occurs.
Now, the corruption preceded him. It preceded Yanukovych. Is it just endemic in Ukrainian government, well, the Ukrainian culture?
pretty, yeah, I would say it is. It's sort of crippled the country for most of its independence. It's a massive hurdle for Ukraine to get over, and it's not an easy task. They are trying. There is some movement here and there. There have been, you know, they've established now what's supposed to be an independent national anti-corruption bureau. They're trying to move forward. That would allow the country to start to investigate and prosecute sort of especially high-level state officials that are involved in corruption. But it's still going to take time for that to take effect. You know, I spoke with someone today who told me that she thinks it could be as much, you know, as far in advance as 6 months before they can even begin looking at cases. On the other hand, you do have a very active civil society, investigative journalists who are really starting to push the issue more than they ever have. So you know, it sort of fits and starts, and it's difficult. But it is something that if Ukraine can't, it is in many ways the bigger war in Ukraine than what's happening in the East.
Now, Andrew, haven't the United States and some European countries debated sending arms to Ukraine?
They certainly have. The U.S. Congress passed a resolution authorizing lethal weapons transfers to Ukraine, but the Obama administration has refrained mostly from doing that so far in consultation with the Germans, who oppose any lethal weapons transfers to Ukraine. I think the main concern here is that it will be pouring gasoline on the fire in the East to arm the Ukrainians, that whatever is provided would not be able to effectively confront the entire Russian army, while at the same time provoking a greater Russian involvement in the East. So it may be counterproductive. The other counterargument to that is that the Ukrainians need an effective deterrent that would make any further advances by the Russians very costly and bloody and might prevent an escalation.
There's an article in today's Times about the tracking of Russian involvement in eastern Ukraine. The independent researchers have used Google Street View, YouTube, and Facebook to confirm Russian involvement, despite the fact that Moscow denies they have any involvement. Do you think that'll have an effect on some of the decision-making now that the Europeans are talking about perhaps easing sanctions on Russia?
Well, it's really been a moving target, the Russian involvement in eastern Ukraine. And it was something when reporters like Saber and I first arrived, this was obviously something we were looking for. And everybody, or many people at least, were able to find Russians fighting on the rebel side, but often they would say they were not members of the military. For a while, the rebel leadership was Russian citizens, the prime minister and the defense minister of the rebel Donetsk Republic. And part of it is the type of state that they've claimed they represent in the East, and the cultural identity they've assumed is the so-called New Russia, and they claim Russian cultural identity and affinity to Russia. And in their mind, Russians who volunteer and come to fight in eastern Ukraine would be accepted into their movement. So there's a very high level of Russian involvement, and it's stated and open. What's claimed to be not what the Russians claim is not happening is that Russians serving military members of the military are fighting in eastern Ukraine.
Although some soldiers have been captured, and they say that they are members of the Russian military.
That's right. So there's quite a bit of evidence coming out now that is happening, and it came out last summer. There was a Russian military incursion into eastern Ukraine at a time when it looked like the Ukrainian army might win this war, and that turned the tide. It's fairly obvious, and I think most Western governments say there's little doubt that Russia is sending men and weapons into the conflict zone.
We'll take a little break and come back with Andrew Kramer, New York Times correspondent in Moscow, and Sabra Ayers, a writer for Al Jazeera America. She is stationed in Kyiv, Ukraine, and we're talking about the crisis in Ukraine and the whole area. Stay with us for more. We're back with Andrew Kramer of the New York Times and Sabra Ayers of Al Jazeera America talking about the crisis in Ukraine. Sabra, how did the rebel takeover of Donetsk, which is eastern Ukraine, affect ordinary citizens there?
Well, you know, in the beginning, there was some there was a lot of local support for what they were calling for, which was to sort of separate from a Western leaning Kyiv government. But immediately, it became pretty dangerous for anyone who sort of was either sitting on the fence on their decisions or was pro-Ukrainian. In other words, they believed that the country should move in the same direction, be a united country and move towards the West. So those people were, many of them were arrested by the rebels, put into basements, threatened, and essentially most of them, if they lean towards that way, were run out of town and have resettled in other parts of Ukraine and some of them in Russia. And then when the fighting started, of course, that had an even greater effect on the civilians there. We've seen, you know, over 6,000, I think the number now is hovering around 6,200 officially, who have been killed in this fighting. And many of them have had their homes destroyed, their apartment buildings destroyed, and have had to evacuate. There are still people living in shelters, bomb shelters. And then, of course, a sort of humanitarian crisis began as supplies, food supplies, medicine supplies have decreased into the rebel-held territories. The Ukrainian government decided, I think it was in November, to stop making pension payments and any state government budget payments to that area that was in the rebel-held parts, which has been extremely difficult for the civilians there, who now have no access to cash. The banking system is cut off, and they are essentially living on humanitarian aid. So the civilian population there is, I mean, it's a difficult place to live now for those who are left.
Even if they're in support of the Ukrainian government rather than the rebel government. Go ahead.
That's true. You get a mixed bag of opinions there. There are a lot of people who do support this idea of what the separatists are trying to fight for, which is, some of them will say, an independent state. A lot of them kind of seem to want to be annexed by Russia, such as Crimea was. That doesn't look like it's going to happen. But and there are people who didn't want to leave because, you know, they had worked all their lives for the apartments they have, the houses they had. They had sunk their savings into it because they never thought that there would be a war here and they don't want to leave what they have. Regardless of who's in charge, they feel that that's their home and they want to stay.
You wrote last year about the Donbas Opera House and the artists who performed there. What happened to the Opera House? And are there any arts or cultural organizations left in Donetsk?
Yeah, surprisingly there are. You would think that there weren't, but life in Donetsk kind of, in some ways, continues on in an almost a normal way. I mean, there are the Donetsk was a city of about 1 million people. They think there's about 750,000 there still. It seems less to me, a lot of the shops have closed because there is no the cash system there is really difficult.
What money is being used? Russian money? Ukrainian money?
Mostly Ukrainian money. I think there is sort of a mixture of both sometimes here and there. But it's, you know, to get cash, the ATMs simply don't work. So you can't get money. The banks are closed. The ATMs don't work. They have this system where you go to a money exchange guy and you tell him you need $100 worth of Ukrainian hryvnia. And he sort of like slides it across electronically, you know, from his bank, almost like a PayPal kind of a system, slides it into his bank. And then someone who's in the government-held territory brings it in across the checkpoints, and he takes off 10% of that. So there's that sort of black market situation that's happening.
Wasn't there a growing IT sector in Donetsk before the war? Has all industry just fallen apart?
the heavy industry that is what the Donbass is famous for has been nearly knocked out. There's a few things that are still working, but, you know, they have a problem with a lot of the stuff that's been damaged by the war, and also it's hard to get anything exported out of there, so such as the coal and the electricity they produce there. But, yeah, there was. I wrote a story about there were some IT, young startup IT companies. A lot of them were being outsourced, or, you know, the states were outsourcing to these young sort of entrepreneurs, and they have left. You know, anyone who was in that area who was sort of an entrepreneur, who was had a startup or any sort of thing like that has left. I haven't met anyone who's been able to stay, because now the rebel-held government, or the rebel government, will try to tax them, and it's really difficult to survive there.
Now, Andrew, the Russian economy has taken a big hit recently. How much is because of it is because of the drop in the price of oil, and how much is are the Western sanctions responsible? Do we know?
Well, I don't think there's an exact way to gauge that. I have heard estimates that around 1% or perhaps a bit more of the decline can be attributed to sanctions, particularly the sanction on the financial sector of the Russian economy that limits lending to many banks to only 3 months. And this has been devastating for banks to roll over large loans with their European counterparts or their American counterparts, and has raised the cost of doing business for the entire Russian economy. Now, a larger part of the problem here is the decline in the oil price of last year, and that combined with the failure of the Russian government to diversify the economy in the years leading up to this crisis. So a lot of the pit that they're in, they dug themselves, and sanctions have only made it worse.
But
likely Russia would be in recession even without the sanctions.
Are ordinary citizens blaming the Putin government for these problems?
There are early signs that they are. Most Russians in polls will blame the United States. They'll point to the low oil prices, and in general, the national pride that they came out, we discussed earlier, over the annexation of Crimea, has insulated the government for a time from much criticism or protest in the population. That may be fading now. In the past month or so, we've seen strikes and economic protests scattered around in the Russian regions that could escalate if the economic crisis here deepens. It should reach a bottom sometime in the fall, when sociologists are expecting the highest level of protest sentiment here in Russia.
My guests are Andrew Kramer of The New York Times and Sabra Ayers of Al Jazeera America. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Sabra, Russia is responsible for, or was responsible for, much of the energy that Ukraine depended on. What's happened now? Has it been cut off completely, the gas and oil?
Well, this has always been a problem between Russia and Ukraine because of the transit pipes that go through Ukraine that Russia pumps its gas to Western Europe. So it hasn't in the past. They've done it too, where they get angry at Ukraine for not paying or for leaning towards the West, and they sort of shut off the pipes, and that affects Western Ukraine. So this is, you know, negotiating with Russia on what the price will be is an ongoing argument, and something that Ukraine is trying, you know, it would, of course, love to wean itself from that, but that's a very difficult task. And you know, we are beginning to see here in Ukraine some effects of the economies slipping, and that, you know, going into the next winter could show be difficult for Ukrainians and heating their houses and that sort of thing.
Has the West offered to help?
The West has come, has offered to help Ukraine with large loan packages and that sort of stuff. The IMF is also giving a lot of loans. That comes with a lot of difficult reforms and economic reforms that Ukraine has to implement, which are painful, and it's something that Ukraine's still working on. And part of that is working on this cleaning up the corruption in the country, so that the Western governments and international funds that are giving them money have confidence that Ukraine's on the right track.
Andrew, hasn't the Ukrainian government been reaching out to business leaders to try to fill government positions? Why business leaders? Because the president is the chocolate king?
Well, there's been a policy in the new government to reach out, particularly to Western business leaders. The finance minister is a former American citizen of Ukrainian descent who worked in finance in Kiev for many years before the change of government. While they're reaching out to the business community, there's also a parallel process of trying to exclude the oligarchs that Saber talked about earlier from any meaningful role in government.
Which has led to the conflict between the president and Igor Kolomoisky.
That's right. It's a real problem in many Soviet states to untangle business and government. The two grew up together in the post-Soviet period, and it's going to be a long-term challenge for Ukraine.
A Ukrainian-born cab driver in New York told me that Poroshenko's government is kidnapping young men and forcing them to serve in the army. Is there any truth in that, Sabra?
No. That sounds like he's been watching a little too much RT. That sounds like typical Russian propaganda that you'll see in on these programs such as Life News and that sort of thing.
Well, he was saying a pox on both their houses.
He was saying what? I'm sorry.
He wanted to put a pox on both their houses, the Russians, Russia and Ukraine.
People aren't being kidnapped to serve in the Ukrainian army. They have had a draft. The Ukrainian army was woefully prepared for this, what they're calling the anti-terrorist operation. They had about 6,000 troops that were sort of battle ready. Most of those guys had served in peacekeeping things in Kosovo and places in Africa. And so they had, over the course of their 23 years of independence, that the Ukrainian army was just disintegrated into almost, nothing. I mean, their weapons had been sold off. The number of troops had dwindled down. So they were in a real bind, which is why we saw a massive amount of volunteers signing up to join these volunteer battalions, which have many of them have now become part of the Interior Ministry's troops, essentially National Reserves, National Guards, and then they've drafted people into the army to make up for the numbers. But it's Ukraine's army is it's really difficult to go up against Russia's army, and it's not Russia they're necessarily going up against, but they're going up against the Russian-backed separatist movement, which is difficult for Ukraine's sort of ill-prepared military.
We're pretty much out of time, but I throw this out to both of you. Is this an insoluble situation? Is there any prospect of resolving it in the near future?
I unfortunately I don't see it resolving itself in the near future. In my opinion, it largely depends on what President Putin decides. I do think, and also what Ukraine does with what I said was this fight against corruption. They've got to get their economy back on track and start moving forward with cleaning out what the people on Maidan stood out there for 3 or 4 months fighting for.
Andrew, from the Russian viewpoint?
I would agree with it. The chances of a quick resolution are slim. Part of it depends on what Russia decides, but also, as unpalatable as it seems to Ukrainians, part of it will depend on Ukraine granting Russia a say in its internal politics. I think this is one of the principal war goals of the Russians. and something that is anathema to what the protesters on the square had protested for, had stood for, and now they may have to surrender some of their independence and some of their pro-Western views if they want peace in their country.
Thank you both so much for being on our show, Andrew Kramer of The New York Times, Sabra Ayers of Al Jazeera America.